Well, it's a delight to see you this morning. We welcome you to our first chapel of spring semester 1999. Today is Founders Day, the beginning of a new tradition at Union University as we have opportunity to think and reflect upon our great history and heritage at this institution. Our historical committee under the direction of Dr. Jimmy Davis has done outstanding research for us as we approach our 175th anniversary together to think about the significance of our past. And one of the recommendations that came out of that time of reflection and study was to begin a Founders Day series so that we would all grow in our appreciation and understanding of the various streams that have come to shape who we are today as an institution. So we thank them, and we trust that God will indeed bless our time together. We're privileged to have each of you here this morning, but we especially would like to recognize those who might be new to the Union family today, as well as we want to acknowledge Dr. Kelvin Moore, who has returned at the answer to many prayers and is back teaching with us this semester. New faculty member Greg Thornberry, instructor in Christian Studies, and our new Dean of Students, Kimberly Thornberry, who will be installed and introduced in a more formal way at fall convocation coming up in a few months. But if you're a new student, new faculty member, you're back new with us this fall, this spring, would you please stand that we might welcome you? We're led in our service today by Dr. Andy Roby and the University Singers, who will be leading us in our music in just a few moments. Dr. Ron Bowd is leading us at the organ. Todd Brady, our minister to the university, led us in our opening invocation. Dr. Davis will be reading scripture, and Dean Thornberry will conclude our service this morning with the benediction. A gift from the family of Polk and Polly Glover has made today's service possible, which funded the events of this day, including the portrait, which will be unveiled for us in a few moments following our address by Dr. Moeller. Today also begins a week of special celebrations on our campus. This is homecoming week. Many activities planned under the coordination of Gary Williams. Let me invite you to participate in as many of those activities leading up to Saturday as possible. I think you will enjoy and appreciate all that takes place this week. Also, that will include a retirement reception for Dr. John Adams at 10 o'clock on Wednesday morning. The beginning of each semester is a wonderful opportunity for new beginnings. Last year, we inaugurated the Center for Scientific Studies and had the privilege of having Dr. Michael Behe with us. Next year, we will hopefully unveil the institutional history, 175-year history, and former Dean Dr. James Baggett will be with us to present next year's Founders Day lecture and also to present the historical volume. But today, we are privileged to have as our special speaker the ninth president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Dr. R. Albert Moeller, Jr. We have invited Dr. Moeller because he has a keen sense of institutional history. Also, there's a very special connection between Union University and the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, especially was that true in the 19th century, and it is true again today. But in the 19th century, James Boyce, who founded Southern Seminary, was granted an honorary doctorate by Union University. And the Manley family connection. Charles Manley was an early president at Union University, and Basil Manley was one of the founding four faculty members at Southern Seminary in 1859. And so there were important connections between the two institutions at that time, and Dr. Moeller knows and lives that history as well as anyone that I know. He is a strategic leader, a convictional author, a well-recognized historian and theologian. Recently, he was named one of the top 50 Christian leaders by Christianity Today, and moreover, Time magazine listed him as one of the top 40 young leaders in America in all fields. He, before coming to serve as president of the oldest Southern Baptist seminary, he served as the editor of the Christian Index, the Baptist State Paper of Georgia, one of the oldest of all the Baptist state papers. And today, Dr. Moeller, we are glad to welcome you to Southern Baptist's oldest educational institution, Union University, and we will hear you gladly. We are delighted to have you with us. Would you join me in welcoming Dr. R. Albert Moeller, Jr. to Union University?
Would you please stand for the reading of God's Word, please? Reading from the book of Joshua, chapter 1, the first 9 verses. After Moses, the servant of the Lord, died, the Lord spoke to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' assistant. The Lord said, "My servant Moses is dead. Now you and all these people go across the Jordan River into the land I am giving to the Israelites. I promised Moses I would give you this land, so I will give you every place you go in the land. All the land from the desert in the south to Lebanon in the north will be yours. All the land from the great river, the Euphrates, in the east to the Mediterranean Sea in the west will be yours too, including the land of the Hittites. No one will be able to defeat you all your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forget you. Joshua, be strong and brave. You must lead these people so that they can take the land that I promised their fathers I would give them. Be strong and brave. Be sure to obey all the teachings that my servant Moses gave you. If you follow them exactly, you will be successful in everything you do. Always remember what is written in the book of the teachings. Study it day and night to be sure to obey everything that is written there. If you do this, you will be wise and successful in everything. Remember that I commanded you to be strong and brave. Don't be afraid, because the Lord your God will be with you everywhere you go." May God bless the reading of his word.
Hallelujah, 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 glory be. President Dockery, faculty, staff, students of Union University, it is a high honor for me to be present to deliver the inaugural Founders Day lecture as you are beginning, as your president said, a new tradition, one that I hope will become a highlight of your annual pattern here at Union University. I appreciated what Dr. Dockery said about the partnership which exists between Southern Seminary and Union University and the fact that it is indeed of very long vintage. And let me express my appreciation even now for the gift this university gave to our founding president in 1859 to make certain that our seminary was well begun. I want to say a word of commendation to you for the choice you have made in being here. For I am convinced that Union University is one of those rare places of learning and Christian scholarship. And I hope that you sense the privilege that is yours in being here. I honestly and very straightforwardly believe that we are living in one of the most critical turning times in the history of human civilization. And those institutions which stand unapologetically and so clearly for the fullness of the Christian world and life view are rare. And the church should celebrate where they exist and where they thrive, such as here at Union University. I appreciated the kind words of introduction. I firmly believe that history will record that Dr. David Dockery is one of the great scholar, theologian, statesman of the evangelical world. And it is with gratitude that I come seeing what the Lord has done in building this institution even in recent years. I come also because I have a charge against you, for you have come to Southern Seminary and taken some of our very best, as recently as Professor and Dean Thornbury. But it is with a sense of indebtedness for the partnership that I come to remind you of something you may already know or something you may learn for the first time, and that is something of the richness of your own history. Founders Day is a time to ponder the inheritance and the significance of the past. Some of you may have heard of the two elderly ladies, well, we can't say that anymore, the two chronologically advanced ladies who were stopped by a state policeman on the interstate highway, and they were pulled over, and the state policeman went up to the window of the car, and the officer looked in, and he said, "Ma'am, do you have any idea how fast you were driving?" And she said, "Oh, officer, I'm very careful as a driver. I'm very particular, and I know exactly how fast I was driving. I was driving 15 miles an hour." The officer said, "Well, you see, ma'am, that's the problem. This is an interstate highway, and nationwide, the minimum speed limit on the interstate highway system is 45 miles an hour." She said, "No, officer, you must be mistaken." She said, "I distinctly remember passing a sign just a few moments ago that said 15, and so I'm driving 15 miles an hour." The officer said, "No, ma'am, you are mistaken. That was the sign indicating that this is Interstate 15. The speed limit is still a minimum of 45. The officer then looked in the window, and he saw this other lady sitting in the passenger seat with her fingers embedded in the dashboard of the car, her hair out in every direction, her eyes frozen in an open-eyed stare. And he said, "Ma'am, what's wrong with her?" And she said, "Oh, that's my sister." And he said, "Well, what in the world's wrong with her?" And she said, "Well, this does explain a great deal." She said, "We just got off Highway 224. You know, sometimes it seems that we live far more of life on Highway 224 than on Interstate 15. The time passes so quickly it is difficult enough to be conscious in the present, much less fully aware of and respectful of the past. Tradition is a word we often use, and yet it is not very popular at the end of the 20th century. As we are so focused on the future, we are in danger of leaving behind the treasured tradition of the past. A tradition is something, nonetheless, that is different than a history. A history is simply there. A tradition is something living. A tradition is something that must be fed and must be nurtured and must be treasured. T.S. Eliot reminded us that tradition is not something that can be merely inherited. It must, in every generation, be earned. And it is a part of our responsibility in this generation to re-earn the tradition of which we have been so richly rewarded and out of which we have been nourished and fed ourselves. Perhaps this Founders Day is an opportunity to reclaim a tradition, to nourish that tradition by reflection. It is an opportunity also to find ourselves situated in something which is older than we are. Something indeed that is even bolder than we are. An institution like Union University experiences a history. But my encouragement to you this morning is that you possess a tradition. You take possession of it. The question of Union University's birth is not uncomplicated. Its paternity is a bit confusing. And as you might imagine, therein lies a tale. Like a William Faulkner novel, the early history of Union University is gothic and it is tragic. And yet a strange glory and dignity still shine through. Tennessee Baptists were determined to establish a school. In the decades leading up to the war between the states, they were determined to establish a college, perhaps even a university. But unfortunately, in that era, Tennessee Baptists could not even hold themselves together. In the decades just prior to the Civil War, the Tennessee Baptist Convention dissolved in the 1840s. And by the time the Tennessee Baptists together were determined to establish a college or university, they seemed unlikely to be able to organize a decent two-person prayer meeting. But in 1836, they had established the Tennessee Baptist Educational Society for Ministerial Improvement. But in the 1840s, it seemed to be going nowhere. The group's title later was changed merely to the Tennessee Baptist Education Society, and somehow movement seemed to begin. I don't know what was gained by dropping the words for ministerial improvement, but hopefully the vision was not there lost. In 1841, on May the 8th, Union University was born in the facilities of Bradley Academy in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. It began classes not yet at the collegiate level, but nonetheless was already known as a university. Why Murfreesboro? Well, because it was central in the state of Tennessee, and central indeed to the entire region. They hoped to draw students from Alabama and Mississippi and regions beyond. But also because this particular project was begun by a convention that was identified as Tennessee and Northern Alabama. Murfreesboro had been the state capital from 1818 to 1825. It had some established educational institutions and even called itself the Athens of the South. Now, quite frankly, that was a bit of overreaching. Pericles was in no danger of having his Athens lose its glory. But for a southern city in the antebellum period, Murfreesboro was a unique location. It's interesting to know that the area also commended itself for the good moral climate it offered. The first catalog in 1848, when the university was offering collegiate level studies, identified Murfreesboro in these words. It is, quote, a beautiful, thriving, and healthy village of 2,000 inhabitants. I want to quote here from the catalog. The inhabitants are remarkable for their morals and intelligence, and so abundant are all the means of life that living can be obtained there as cheap as anywhere else upon the earth. Nowhere can young men be more safe. Well, for what more could one ask? However, Dr. Baggett in his historical investigations has already determined that there was a saloon for every 125 men, women, and children in this town of remarkable moral climate. It nonetheless did commend itself for the establishment of Union University, and there the college began its studies, offering courses which genuinely represented the very best any educational institution had to offer in the 1840s. Classes in Greek and in Latin. The required curriculum included readings and recitations in such work as Xenophon's Anabasis, in Virgil, Livy, Homer, rhetoric, history, archaeology, natural philosophy, moral philosophy, and logic. It was intended for the training of ministers. And a school of theology was one of the central features of Union University in Murfreesboro. However, I want to read from the 1872 catalog. While it is not, and here I quote, of course, proposed to give a complete and extended training for the ministry, as is afforded by the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, to which institution we encourage all our students having the ministry in view to go, end quote. I have had my research assistant checking this, and so far as I can see, that has never been repealed in any subsequent Union University catalog, and thus I assume it is in full force. When you do look at the curriculum from the 1840s, it is very interesting to see the classical approach to education there undertaken. This was not a lowest common denominator curriculum. This was a curriculum like one would have found at Princeton or Brown or Harvard or Yale or any other major educational institution of its day. As I looked back to this primary source material, I gained a new respect for the founders of Union University in Murfreesboro, for they were determined that Baptist young people, Christian young persons, should have the very highest quality of education. Required of every student was an annual oral examination, frequent recitations by memory. Question that may be on your heart and mind is, what was the tuition? Well, for freshmen and sophomores, it was $20 a term. For juniors and seniors, it was $25 a term. Let me just tell you, if you do an econometric projection, you do not want to pay those fees in 1840s dollars. That was not low tuition. It is apparent that Union University in the 1840s was called upon to fund itself in this way, and it is again one of the miracles of its birth that it was able to thrive and to grow in such circumstances. Well, what about the founders? This is Founders Day. We must begin with R.B.C. Howell, pastor of the Baptist Church in Nashville, a Baptist aristocrat, urbane and sophisticated, the second president of the Southern Baptist Convention, who served 8 years in that high office. He was also the founder and the editor of a paper known as The Baptist, later the Tennessee Baptist. In 1839, R.B.C. Howell offered the resolutions which led to the founding of Union University. R.B.C. Howell was one of those pastors of great dignity and influence in the state of Tennessee who projected that influence, indeed, throughout the Southern Baptist Convention. Howell was concerned that if Tennessee Baptists, and indeed if the Southern Baptist Convention, were ever to have a trained ministry ready for service on the front lines of the Great Commission and in the frontier as it was then expanding westward across the United States, capable, competent, and outstanding educational institutions must be established. And Union University was the seed of his vision as he made those resolutions and by force of personality saw that sufficient resources were gained and acquired for the university to begin its work. The university's first president was Joseph H. Eaton. Now, he had a pedigree. One very interesting biographical article on Eaton begins this way, with a genealogy. Elder Joseph H. Eaton was the son of Joseph Eaton, who was the son of David Eaton, who was the son of John Eaton, who was the son of Joseph Eaton, who was the son of John Eaton, who immigrated from Wales A.D. 1686. Obviously a family of dignity and memory, but little creativity in names. Joseph H. Eaton was born on the Ohio frontier in 1812. He became associate pastor to R.B.C. Howell and was elected professor of Latin and literature in Union University in its very founding. And as you look to the original catalog of the university, you will see there is a blank where the president's name should be, and Joseph H. Eaton's name is the first of the faculty members named with his responsibility in Latin and literature. However, before the year was out, he himself was elected president, and with the office of president came, as was customary in that day, the chair of moral philosophy. And thus he taught for many years and led the institution, and under his leadership in 1847, the college offered its first collegiate level courses. The university prospered under Eaton's presidency. He was a man also of dignity, a Christian scholar, and it is interesting to note that on this original faculty, you see a pattern very much common to academic institutions of the era. The faculty could teach in virtually any department, for they had had to pass rigorous examinations in their own collegiate studies in each one of these areas. The faculty would meet together to decide who would teach what discipline. Very different than the era of specialization through which modern higher education has passed and we see in the present. President Eaton's wife, Esther Treadwell Eaton, offered classes for women beginning in 1851 and founded the Tennessee Baptist Female Institute. That is the beginning of coeducational education at Union. However, the men and women did not study together, although they used some of the same facilities. Later catalogs offered that a brother and sister could both come to Murfreesboro and be enrolled in component parts of Union University, and one could watch over the other. In 1859, Joseph H. Eaton died unexpectedly at the age of 46. His last words are recorded as an encouragement to the students of the university that each be a Christian. He left a legacy. However, in many ways, the momentum of the university died there in Murfreesboro with the death of Joseph H. Eaton. Another one of the pillars of this early era was T.T. Eaton, the son of Joseph H. Eaton. He is a fascinating figure, an orator and an organizer who was elected professor of mathematics and natural sciences in 1857. He was a graduate of Washington College. However, after the war, he always listed it as Washington and Lee University. A bit of Southern sectional pride represented there. He was one of the founding trustees of Southwestern Baptist University in Jackson, but to that story we must later return. He went on to be one of the most famous and controversial pastors in the Southern Baptist Convention, pastor of several of the largest churches in our denomination, editor of the Western Recorder in Kentucky, and pastor of the Walnut Street Baptist Church in Louisville, Kentucky, where he caused no small amount of consternation on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. But the last of those I would mention to you this morning, in this sense, is J.R. Graves. There is no adequate time this morning to describe J.R. Graves, except to say he was the greatest Southern Baptist controversialist of the 19th century and perhaps of any century thus far. A Virginian by birth, in 1846, he was elected editor of the Tennessee Baptist, that paper that had been begun by R.B.C. Howell. Under J.R. Graves' editorship, the paper earned the largest circulation of any Baptist newspaper before the Civil War. It was Graves who led to the establishment of the first theological chair at Union University in the 1850s. And yet it was Graves who also pressed a specific theological agenda upon not only Union University, but Tennessee Baptist, and not only Tennessee Baptist, but the Southern Baptist Convention as a whole. That was the agenda of landmarkism. It is represented in the fact that the first incumbent of the chair at Union University, for which the funds have been secured by J.R. Graves and his brother, C.Z. Graves, was Professor J.M. Pendleton. In 1856, he had written a volume entitled An Old Landmark Reset, which was published by none other than J.R. Graves. This was a form of Baptist high churchmanship we know as landmarkism. It takes its name as a movement from Pendleton's tract. It stresses the primacy of the local church, represented by such features as closed communion and rejection of alien immersion. No ecumenical entanglements, no bureaucratic machinery. It is a movement, the legacy of which is still among us, and from which we have much to learn. It stressed Baptist secessionism in history, and unfortunately led us to be in secession by this scheme with some with whom we would not seek to join. Pendleton assumed the chair in 1857, and Pendleton and Graves together exerted quite an influence upon Union University and through Union University upon the entire denomination. We should note that the most intense theological and denominational controversy of the 19th century among Southern Baptists was a battle royal between R.B.C. Howell and J.R. Graves. Without going into detail there, we must note simply that Union University's early history was convoluted and confusing, but it was never boring. It would be interesting to speculate how the landmarkism debate might have shaped Union University in Murfreesboro into the last decades of the 19th century. But we will never know how that might have turned out. For in 1861, when war came, classes ended. And from 1866 to 1872, the university tried to stay alive, but without any adequate support. The last president was Professor Charles Manley, the son of Basil Manley Sr., one of the most famous and influential families in the Southern Baptist Convention. But even under the leadership of Charles Manley, the school in Murfreesboro simply could not survive. There was no adequate support, and it closed its doors in 1873. And yet, even in that apparent death, Union gave a gift to Tennessee Baptists, and it was the gift of Union. For in the year following the death of Union University in Murfreesboro, the Tennessee Baptist Convention was reestablished. And in that same year, the Tennessee Baptist Educational Society gave the Union University property and assets, such as they were in Murfreesboro, to Southwestern Baptist University, located in Jackson, Tennessee. Southwestern Baptist University never took possession of the property because of legal complications, but you know the rest of the story. In 1907, Southwestern Baptist University in Jackson, Tennessee, having never taken the property, did take the name and became Union University. Thus, Union University and its heritage in Murfreesboro is a part of your heritage as well. Five issues I would commend to you from this history. First, the emphasis upon and by the founding faculty and the founding era of Union University on the commitment to the local church. This institution began with a heart to serve the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. Secondly, a vision for Christian scholarship, as evidenced by the quality of the curriculum and the strenuousness of the studies required. There was clearly a belief and a commitment that Christians should be scholars. Third, the purpose of unifying Baptists. Union University was to be a school for the training of ministers and laypersons, but also it was to be a unifying point, a symbol of the growing unity Tennessee Baptists hoped would emerge. Fourth, it was a model of sacrificial stewardship. For many Baptists of that day gave virtually everything they had that Union University might exist. The future generations might have the opportunity such as is yours. And fifth, the dedication to truth. When you look at the early documents, the primary documents of Union University, there was a sense that those founders knew they were stewards of the mysteries of God. They had the responsibility to perpetuate a faithful legacy of Christian teaching. Well, the Union University legacy in Murfreesboro ended in failure, would say some historians. And yet we have to ask the question, is it really failure? I would argue it was not failure at all. It was the failure of a dream that that university might be in Murfreesboro, and yet that dream moved to Jackson, Tennessee. The original catalog of Union University in Murfreesboro included a statement of behavior and a disciplinary code. And the entire catalog culminated in a final statement, which reads this way: the result being a good son, a useful citizen, and member of society, a Christian scholar. I would commend to you that original mission statement, that the purpose of Union University now should be that it produce good sons and daughters, pointing to the vital issues of character and integrity. Useful citizens, pointing to the essentials of service and responsibility, and Christian scholars, inculcating a vision for Christian learning. In his inaugural address on October the 17th of 1996, President Dockery said this: the purpose of this institution is to educate students so that they will be prepared for whatever vocation God has called them, enabled and equipped with the competencies necessary to think Christianly and to perform skillfully in the world. equipped to be servant leaders who impact the world as change agents based on a full-orbed Christian world and life view. It sounds to me as if you are headed back to the future, as you are headed on to the future, to God's glory. May you earn the tradition and claim it as your own. Amen.
Thank you, Dr. Moeller, for that very enlightening look at our past, understanding of the influence of Union University at Murfreesboro upon the Jackson tradition that we now enjoy. We have the privilege this time to unveil the Founders Day portrait, and I'm going to ask Dr. Jimmy Davis and Todd Brady to help me at this time. Let me thank Robert Nettles, the artist from Mississippi who performed the beautiful work on this portrait, and again, Polk and Polly Glover for their wonderful gift that enabled us to enjoy this beautiful portrait. It is a portrait that ties together Murfreesboro and Jackson campuses by the administration building on each campus, as well as a looking to the future with a look at Hammonds Hall. It includes some of the stalwart leaders that Dr. Moeller brought to our attention even this morning, Drs. Eaton, Graves, Pendleton, and Howell, as well as folks like Peenick, for whom this grand building is named, George Savage, for whom this chapel is named, Tigert, who served as interim president twice and for whom each senior student longs to the recipient of the Tigert Medal. Mrs. Prince, who founded the Conservatory of Music and served here for over 30 years. But this portrait will hang in the administration area. I would invite you to come and look at it, to reflect upon it, and to thank God for our rich heritage. And as we unveil it, would you please thank Polk and Polly Glover for their gift to Union University.